Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Thank you so much for tuning in. Henrik here with Red Ice TV, and today we have an excellent interview lined up for you with none other than Dr. E. Michael Jones, who returns to the show. I think it was 2014. Yeah, last time he was on with us. Amazing how quickly the time passes. Of course, back then we talked about libido dominandi, sexual revolution, and also about the Jewish revolutionary spirit. And I do actually want to spend some time on these books again and these works and kind of reintroduce some of you guys to some of this. I think far more people today are actually aware of E. Michael Jones's work than maybe back in 2014. He's been on a lot of shows recently as well, so it's great to have him back, of course. But there's a number of other issues we're going to dive into as well, including actually Sweden's role in the sexual revolution, or this sexual liberation movement, if you will, and how Swedish cinema was tied into that. It's a very, very interesting discussion. There's a number of things lined up here today. Welcome back, E. Michael Jones. It's great to have you here again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
There's a number of things we have lined up. We want to talk about a number of your books, of course. You've been making a lot of interview shows and stuff like that recently, and we've gotten a lot of requests to have you back, so it's wonderful to have you here. But let me begin with this, actually. We had a pastor out of the U.S., Pastor Anderson, that actually has become the first, I don't know if it is the first person, but this article claims it's the first person banned from Ireland because of his supposed anti-Semitic and also anti-gay views. Here's another source from the Euronews. U.S. anti-gay pastor Stephen Anderson banned from Ireland. Now, I know that you travel a lot as well, and there are some overlap in some of the topics and stuff like that. Have you been restricted in your travel yet? I think that this is something that's going to become much more prevalent in the next couple of years here.
No, I haven't been restricted at all. As a matter of fact, the TSA upgraded me, so I don't have to take my shoes off now to get on an airplane. But that doesn't change the situation. This isn't about me. This is about the situation. And what you saw in the last week or so, in the aftermath of the Poway synagogue shooting in California, the ambassador to the United Nations, Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, came to New York and announced that the time for discussion is over. Okay, no more talk. We are going to make anti-Semitism a crime now. That's the order from the Israeli ambassador, and America has to jump up and start acting on that order. Now, what you're seeing here is a group of people who have lost control of the narrative. Okay, the mainstream media is controlled by Jews, Jewish interests. They own it. And now they've lost control of the narrative in spite of owning that, largely because of the type of stuff we're doing here right now. And so they're trying to regain it by becoming more and more draconian. More and more draconian speech codes being imposed on us. So they're using the Poway shooting as an excuse to now crack down more on anti-Semitism, or what they're calling anti-Semitism, which is another word for people speaking out on topics that they don't like. So shortly before that, I got into a discussion with that Dr. Michael Brown, who's real polite when he starts talking to me. And then as soon as I get on the show, he starts putting words in my mouth. And he ends up calling me after we do the interview, he calls me a Christian anti-Semite. Well, why did you do that? Because he did not like my interpretation of 1 Thessalonians 2 or the Gospel of St. John or other scriptures. So let's put these parts together now, okay? Now, Dr. Brown, if you disagree with Dr. Brown about 1 Thessalonians 2, he will call you a Christian anti-Semite. And if the Israeli ambassador gets his way, then he will throw you in jail because you disagreed with Dr. Brown's cockamamie, crazy scripture scholarship. That's the situation right now. That's what we have to explain, and that's the danger that we face here.
Yeah, I mean, this is unprecedented for being America. We had the First Amendment, and I know many Americans have looked over to Europe and said, you guys are crazy, especially Central Europe, of course. But you can't talk about certain things, you can't question things, you can't have a different view on things, and people do end up in jail. And it looks like they are definitely going for that in America now, too. Speech right. Restrictions, your ability right. to communicate certain things, right?
Right. So I mean, what do we have? America is a country that went from barbarism to decadence without ever finding civilization along the way. Okay, so we don't have a culture, we don't have, you know, don't have a history, but we do have freedom of speech, and we have the First Amendment, and we have freedom of religion. This goes directly, this is a direct assault on all that is left of being an American, yeah. Because that's all that's left. And on top of that, it is a restriction on our freedom of religion, because what you're saying now is that the Jew now has the definitive say on how you're allowed to read the Bible. That's what it's come down to. That my conversation with Dr. Brown made that clear. So I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think it's going to pass. The anti-BDS legislation in Texas, where you had to sign a statement if you wanted to be hired that you would not criticize Israel, has been struck down as unconstitutional. Florida is next. They want to pass that bill there. I don't think it's going to pass. I think the tide is heading in the opposite direction. I think that the Jews, once again, because they have no sense of logos, they don't know where the boundaries are, and I think they push too far, and now you're seeing a huge reaction setting in, not just here, but probably the best example is in Poland right now with that 447 legislation. It has united the entire nation.
I saw that, and this is basically a way for getting the Poles to pay for Holocaust victims, right? And they're going to extort money. And it was the U.S. State Department is going to put pressure on Poland that they need to track and trace how much money they spend on this and stuff. I can pull it up here in a moment. But what sparked this one? And what can America do about it on top of that matter?
Well, America is now, the foreign policy is controlled by three rich Jews, Sheldon Adelson, Bernard Marcus, and Paul Singer. And so as a result, Trump, in order to stay in power, to protect himself from the deep state, wants Sheldon Adelson to protect him, but he has to do his bidding, and this is putting pressure on Poland. You know, of course, that Poland invaded Germany in 1939. Well, no, wait a minute. I thought I got that wrong. Germany invaded Poland in 1939. So why are the Poles paying reparations payment for being invaded by Germany? I don't get it. And then secondly, if you want the real story to come out, talk about the Jewish commissars that Stalin appointed after World War II and what they did to the Polish people. That story will come out now. Because the Poles are simply not going to take this. They're not. I saw the rally. I saw the politician gave a little speech in English. It's on YouTube now, where he says basically Netanyahu, Sheldon Adelson. I forget who else it was, but anyway, go to hell. That's what he said.
Interesting. Yeah, the protest was aimed at marking Poles' opposition to the Justice for Uncompensated Survivors Today Act. The Just Act, a 2018 U.S. law requiring the State Department to report to Congress on what European countries have done to compensate Holocaust survivors or their heirs for assets seized under Nazi or communist rule. Thousands of Polish nationalists took to the street on Warsaw on Saturday, gathering before the U.S. Embassy to protest what they felt was an unfair piece of U.S. legislation trying to unjust extract wealth from Poland. Right. I think they're pushing way too hard, to be honest, aren't they?
I think so, too. I think there's going to be a huge reaction. Please, this politician was great because he didn't blame the Americans, okay? Please don't blame us Americans for the fact that the Jews have taken over our foreign policy. Please have a little bit of consideration here.
So this is crazy. They're going very hard on this. And, of course, you'd think that this would just make people more and more angry. Perhaps.
This is the way God works in human history. This is what Hegel called the cunning of reason. You bring about the exact opposite of what your intention is, because your intention cannot contradict God's plan. Hegel called it the cunning of reason, die List der Vernunft. The invasion, the neocon invasion of Iraq is a classic example of this. They destroy Iraq, and in doing that, they create Iran as the great regional power. So we're seeing this happening in Poland right now as we speak.
Yeah, they said, this is Poland, not Polin, the crowd chanted, referring to the Hebrew name for the country, which protesters carrying signs reading, Poland has no obligations and Holocaust hyenas to mark their dissatisfaction. Protesters fear that Jewish organizations could use a U.S. legislation to demand up to $300 billion in restitution. $300 billion, Dr. Jones. That is crazy.
From Poland. not exactly the richest country in the world.
It's not. A lot of people are fleeing, but they're going to the UK for work. They're going even to Sweden for work, even America, right. Of course. So, yeah, the it's better in Poland now, I think, than it maybe ever has been. And they're on the up and up overall. But still, you know, it's crazy. But again, I know that Poland receives a little bit of aid, I think, from the US. And, you know, again, why should they, right? Just disconnect with that kind of business. But regardless, that's all they could do, essentially, short of invading Poland because they don't apply the rules, right?
No. I mean, how much aid do you get? And will that make up for $300 billion? No, I don't think so.
No, exactly. So this is very strange that they're doing this. But there you go. This is the times we live in. Now, okay, so that's... And I should mention, too, by the way, before we leave the topic, that, of course, the media is calling this a far-right, you know, gathering, and it's all neo-Nazis talking about this. This is just, I mean, that's fine if they're out and protesting, obviously, but it's like, it's just a lot of normal Poles that are out in the street and tired of being blackmailed, essentially, in this way.
No? That's right. The Jews have united the nation of Poland here. It's broad-based. It's not fringe groups here.
And do you remember that story? It was in the press like maybe a few months ago now, maybe even 6 months, about all the names, right? That they didn't want to have the name Polish death camps, right? Poland, they passed legislation that said it was Germans or don't rope us into this kind of thing. And it was a big international kind of scandal. Do you remember that?
Yeah, and you remember what Benjamin Netanyahu did? He shows up there, immediately breaks that law, and then he says Poles imbibe anti-Semitism from their mother's milk. And then he's shocked that the Poles didn't like that. Yeah. I mean, what's wrong with you guys? What's wrong with you? What's too thin-skinned a little bit here? And then he says, oh, I was misunderstood. So he sends his assistant something or other, and he makes it even worse. He doubles the insult. I mean, let's go back to diplomacy 101, guys. This is not and at this point, they were trying to lure them into some type of conference for the Eastern European nations. These guys don't know. They don't have limits. They don't know boundaries.
No, it's very interesting. So the question that you bring up again, just quickly going back to Pastor Anderson here and his supposed anti-Semitism and the way that he's interpreting the Bible, the way he's looking at this. Being banned from countries. This is not the first time we've seen actually a lot of, especially nationalists and people on the right, of course, conservatives even, being banned from Australia, from the UK. This has been happening now for months and months. But the point is, this has now become almost a kind of a sense of a normal behavior that if a country just don't feel that they like a certain person, they can just say, well, you know, he's a divisive figure. We're not going to allow him into our countries. And we're seeing restricted travel. And in this case, it's based on basically discussions about the Bible or interpretations about the Bible. Right. And I've seen, too, calls for actually what you just mentioned, due to the fact that Bible contains uncomfortable, I guess is a better word, truths about certain things. They're talking about actually banning and censoring certain portions of the Bible, at least in certain bookstores. Have you seen this?
I haven't, but I'm. It's only the logical conclusion of what we're talking about here. The big thing now is calling people Christian anti-Semites. What that means is they disagree with your interpretation of the Bible. The United States was founded by people who didn't want to go to jail because they had a different interpretation of the Bible. This is the only thing that unites this United States history, for better or for worse. And now, in a classic example of overreach, they're going to throw anybody in jail who disagrees with the official reading of the Bible. That's not going to work. I mean, it's not going to work. I'm telling you right now.
Yeah, it's definitely a crazy town.
You've got people here who have been told from the time they were small that if you deny Christ, you cannot be saved. And then they point to martyrs in Rome who marched into the Colosseum because they would not offer incense to the emperor. Well, these stories go back way back, and you've got people who probably, maybe not all, but some people are willing to die for what they believe because their ancestors did that in Rome in the Colosseum. Do you want to take these people on? I don't think so.
Now, so... let me tie this together here in terms of the pastor again, the fact that he's been called anti-gay as well. It's interesting that, again, you have things in the Bible that are very clear about homosexuality, right? So is there going to be religious freedom enough that's going to allow people to talk about what it says in the Bible. And I wanted to kind of squeeze this through the lens of Sweden, actually, because we had a recent story come out where parents are critical of the fact that there are schools in certain regions of Sweden that are going to be forced to participate in the Pride Festival, right, while they're at school. This is elementary school kind of stuff. And it's not only, by the way, for elementary school kids. The police have participated, the Swedish police have participated in Europride. The armed forces have done campaigns like this one. We don't always march straight, right? The whole thing about how they're participatory in this. And it's extended itself to, I don't actually have that link up right now, but it's extended itself even to the court, people high up in the court system also participating, actually questioning their impartiality and their ability to be impartial when it comes to rulings and things, because they kind of take a side, if you will, on this issue. But I know that you wanted to talk a little bit about how Sweden ended up where we are when it comes to but not only homosexuality, but just the promotion of the over-sexualization and the use of sex as kind of a mechanism of control. So lead us into this discussion a little bit.
Yes. As I said, what we're seeing is the reductio ad absurdum, or the endgame scenario of basically the use of sexual liberation as a form of political control. It's now reached the point of transgenderism and homosexuality in the United States. Same thing with you. It didn't begin this way. No one in his right mind could begin with something this alien to the human experience. Okay, it began in the 60s, and when I heard that I was coming on your program, I remembered, I just saw an announcement for a book. It's called Swedish Cinema and the Sexual Revolution. It's a collection of essays that came out in 2016, and so I got the book, and I started reading the book, and you know, I mean, some of the names are familiar with me, I'm familiar with, like Ingmar Bergman, okay, I knew who he was. And Olaf Palme, and then there's, you know, it's going down the list. I don't know what all the names, like Gunnar Gunnarsson and Bjorn Bjornsson and B.B. Anderson. And then suddenly I come across Harry Schein. Wait a minute. Who's Harry Schein? That doesn't sound Swedish to me. It turns out that Harry Schein was the big mover and shaker during the Cultural Revolution in Sweden in the 1960s. Harry Schein was a Jewish emigre born in Austria, sent by his mother out of the country to escape Hitler, and established himself there in some type of strange way. Okay, I don't know how he did it, but anyway, by 1964, he shows up in Stockholm and he forms this Swedish film institute. You'll forgive me because my Swedish isn't that good, but the interesting thing about this, okay, is that you got these people who are writing this book. It's a collection of essays. They're all bright people. They're all associated with the university. They all say Harry Schein was a crucial figure here. And then you're waiting, and they can't really explain why, because they don't have the big picture here. And the point here is you won't have the big picture because you're connected with the university, and you have to say, you have to know certain things before you can connect the dots here. So one of the things you have to know is, number one, that sexual liberation is a political, a form of political control. And number two, that in terms of cultural subversion and the corruption of sexual morals, the Jews played a leading role during this period of time. Harry Schein was a Jew. Now, there's I haven't done all the research here, but it turns out that Ingmar Bergman's father baptized Harry Schein. I don't know what that means. I don't know who Ingmar, don't understand that at all, but it didn't have much of an effect, because what we're talking about in 1964 was the overthrow of all forms of censorship throughout the world. This was an international effort. Now, obviously, the crucial group here was Hollywood. The Jews in Hollywood had been under basically Catholic control for about 30 years, 31 years, ever since the production code got placed in Hollywood. And they didn't like it. They didn't like the fact that Catholics restricted them. They were in a bind in terms of financially, because they were competing against television. They had to come up with big Hollywood productions in Italy, because the labor was cheap. They needed a better way to compete, and nudity was obviously one of the simplest ways. And so in 1964, the Hollywood declared war on the production code. Now, they did it in a way that was not successful. They created sex farces like Kiss Me Stupid, which starred Dean Martin and Kim Novak, and it bombed. It was terrible. And what they needed was something that gave basically nudity redeeming social value, because that was the criterion in the American legal system. In other words, if it had redeeming social value, it was not obscene. Or let's put it simply, if it were art, then it was okay, and it didn't matter what you saw objectively, okay? Well, who's going to be the man, the art guy, who's going to basically deliver the goods? Well, guess who it is? It's Ingmar Bergman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ingmar Bergman was the art cinema guy of this period. The only possible competition was Federico Fellini in Italy. But Bergman was the man who had the ability to give you the sense, this is a work of art, man. I am really, you know, this is it. And so he had won, he had connections with Hollywood. He'd won the Oscar twice for Best Foreign Film. And now in 64, it's the year to break the code, and he comes up with a movie called The Silence. Or Silence. What's that in, do you remember what that is in Swedish?
No, I can find it out while you talk about it here, but okay. I think it was a different, I don't think it was Tyst Natt, I think it was something else, Silence. I'll find it. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Anyway, so one of the professors who's writing these essays said, Shine deliberately created this movie as a code breaker.
Okay, it was actually the Silence. It's Tyst Natt, and it was in Swedish, 1963. Says here.
Right.
Yep.
So it was conceived of as a code breaker.
And by the way, Ingrid Thulin, who starred in the movie, later on went on to marry Harry Schein, by the way.
Right.
Yep.
Right. So he's got and at this point he inserts a clause into the Swedish censorship operation saying if it has artistic value, it cannot be obscene. So the film is immediately shipped to Germany. And it's used to break the code, to break the back of resistance to obscenity in Germany. Now, I discussed this. I have an e-book. I was in Bavaria. I gave a speech in Bavaria in October. I wrote a book, an e-book called Werner Heisenberg and Jewish Science. And it covers the whole story of the obscenity crusade, the anti-obscenity crusade in Germany. Basically, the church had come up with the equivalent of the Legion of Decency. In America, it was called the Volksvertbund, and they were complaining about Schmutz und Schund.
Yeah.
I don't know what the Swedish is, but it's like filth and smut, okay? And filth and smut has this archaic sound to it, and they were losing the battle. The church is losing the battle, and then Bergman comes along and just delivers the knockout blow in 1964 in Germany with the film The Silence. Just delivered the knockout blow in Germany. That was it. It was over. And at that point, from then on, you had a flood of increasingly obscene material. I arrived there as a teacher in 1973, and my students were going to see Der Schulmädchen Report. 13. Folge, you know, basically teen softcore porn. Or they were watching Las Juckenkumpel, which was about porn in the Ruhrgebiet, the worker setting. Or they were watching Beim Jodeln juckt die Lederhosen, which was Bavarian porn. This was all aimed at the German audience. It would not have succeeded anyplace else because it was all sex farce. Okay? What you needed in America was something serious, and Bergman was the guy who gave this aura of seriousness. And so at that point, it got there, it kind of prepared the way, and then 1 year later, the code was broken with the pawnbroker, which was the porn, it's Holocaust porn. There's no other way to describe it. They used the Holocaust as a way of just shutting you down. You can't. The Catholic censors were totally embarrassed by this thing. They're saying, well, we just passed O Nostra Aetate. We're supposed to be friends with the Jews. And the Jews mercilessly exploited the situation, used the Holocaust to put bare tits on the screen, and that was the end of the production code. And it was being orchestrated by Harry Schein over there in Sweden.
Yeah, I had one film up here which people, I think, have heard of. This is the one that claims to kind of, you know, be the groundbreaking work, but this is later, so that's interesting. I didn't know that about the Tystnad and the Silence. I haven't heard that, but that you remember The Curious Yellow, right? That was an international success, was it not? It's not by Bergman, but it's a different director, Göran Lindgren, I think.
It's by his assistant. Is his name Sjöman?
Sjöman, yes. Written by Vilgot Sjöman, yes.
Yeah, well, he was Bergman's assistant.
Oh, interesting.
It's
produced by Jonas Film, which is Bergman's production company. So there you go.
Right. Yeah. And at a certain point, Schein became Bergman's producer. So this, I remember as I think I was 19 years old at the time, and suddenly all these, Sweden, man, it's the sexual paradise. It's free love. You know, they had to use something like this. We had already, in a sense, been softened up by Gunnar Myrdal, who showed up in the 40s to basically talk about the racial situation. But this was the paradigm of all type of advanced thought. It was Sweden. And Bergman was the guy. And after this, I Am Curious Yellow, it led to a number of Supreme Court decisions. I Am Curious Yellow doesn't have redeeming social value. So you have this lady having sex on the, taking off her clothes, having sex on the screen, but you intersperse that with clips of Martin Luther King talking about civil rights. And now you've got the best of both worlds. And that was what was the engine that was used to break the production code. And that was the beginning of the end in terms of expanding this realm of sexual liberation as a form of control. Within 6 years, I did, in John Cardinal Kroll and the Cultural Revolution, I reviewed the archival material, the conversations and letters back and forth between Eli Landau, the producer, and the head of the Legion of Decency. And Landau says, it'll inaugurate a new era of great films. Well, within 6 years, it was Deep Throat.
That's amazing how quickly that moved, yeah.
It happened with almost overnight. The intermediate step was I Am Curious Yellow.
Yeah, that's right.
These films coming from Sweden, and then finally it got knocked down completely with hardcore pornography in first-run theaters. It's that simple.
Yeah, and just remind people again of what that. We'll continue talking about this because it's very interesting. But just remind people again of why they are using the, why does this work so well, keeping people in a state of base carnal kind of drives, right?
Because lust darkens the mind. Okay, that's the classic way. The picture on the cover of my book is Samson. That's the biblical version of this. Samson was undefeatable in battle, but he succumbed to lust. And the symbol of his succumbing was basically, there she is, she's cutting out his eyes. She cut his hair, and then she plucked out his eyes. So you're blind. Lust makes you blind. All you do is follow your passions. St. Augustine said, a man has as many masters as he has vices.
That's right.
So you remove sex from the realm of morality, and you say you can do whatever you want, and then you become a slave of your passions. And then the people who control your passions control you by manipulating. And the best way to control your passions now in this world is the manipulation of media. So the culmination of this is, in a way, I mean, the introduction of that book, I say, the Israeli army invaded Ramallah, and when they took over the TV stations, they started broadcasting pornography. Well, they showed their hand there. Why are the Israelis broadcasting pornography to Palestinians? Because they want to entertain them? Because they want to liberate them? No, because they know it will distract them, it will derange them, and they can use that as a form of control. It's the definitive proof, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, definitely. And there was actually a quote even in the Wiki page on Harry Schein right there. Let's just bring that up real quick. And it says that Schein was often engaged in public debates and demonstrated a distinctive understanding of the use of media. Right. So there was a clear understanding that this is how you do it. And I'm curious to ask you why you think that they picked Sweden. It might have been a country ripe for the picking, but could it have something to do with, let's say, the... How do I put this? 60s, was Sweden at that point a country to look up to in success? I know that 70s and 80s were, but maybe it was even back in the 60s, right? An international gem that people could look at and say, oh, whatever they're doing something right. And look at how liberated they are sexually. Could that have been part of it?
That's right. That's exactly what it was. Sweden was the wealthiest country in Europe at that time. Beyond that, Sweden was a socialist country. Gunnar Myrdal was brought over because he was a socialist, and the people who were running America at that point, the foundations, they were all involved in the same type of socialism.
And it's funny, let's remind people who doesn't know that he wrote An American Dilemma, The Negro Problem and Modern Democracy. This guy had never lived under those conditions. He knew nothing about it, and he came over to be an advisor, which contributed to change a lot of laws in America, by the way.
Yeah, Brown versus School Board. I've said this before. I said it in Slaughter of Cities. He did not write that book. He came as the front man for the psychological warfare establishment, and they wrote the book. You can't write a 1,200-page book. I've written a 1,200-page book, okay? You cannot write a book like that in 6 months when you're traveling around the country and then suddenly the Nazis invade your country and you rush back to Europe. He could not have written that book. So he didn't write it. He was the front man. But the other point I'd like to make is that Sweden was involved in its own form of social engineering at this point. Because at this time, you had a large movement of people from the countryside into cities like Stockholm. And the way they dealt with this, they were going to deal with it the same way that the social engineers dealt with the black migration from the south into cities like Chicago. Build high-rise Bauhaus Wohnmaschinen and warehouse these people there. It's the same thing as Gropiusstadt in Berlin. It's the same thing as Nova Huta. This was the new socialist man, and they wanted to keep these people happy. So at the same time that they're exporting Bergman to America, they're importing Joe Sarno to Sweden. Put them up. The million program.
That's what
I was thinking of.
Very important, helping to break the soul of the Swede. These are horrific psychological experiments, which is a crime to architecture. And they're still standing, many of them today. They're so ugly.
I know. And that's different than America. The Robert Taylor Homes, I was in the Robert Taylor Homes. My Russian daughter-in-law, when she saw that, she said, it's just like the Soviet Union.
Yeah,
well, it was. They were both Bauhaus creations.
Yeah.
I knew a woman who grew up, black woman who grew up in the project. The Robert Taylor Homes have now been blown up. They were blown up because the property is too valuable. They're not going to warehouse Negroes there. They're in the suburbs, and the white people want to move back because the property is too valuable. You have Nova Huta. You have Gropiusstadt. These are breeding grounds of drug addiction, of anomie. The classic expression of Gropiusstadt in Berlin is Wir Kinder von Bahnhof Zoo, which is a story about a teenage prostitute heroin addict and David Bowie's role in that whole thing. Nobody can stand it. Everybody's going crazy. So if you're in Poland, you get drunk every day. If you're in Berlin, you shoot up heroin. I don't know what you do in Sweden. In Sweden, you watch Joe Sarno porn film.
Yeah, something like that.
And tell yourself how liberated you are.
But exactly.
This was a monument to failure. And I'm saying that Sweden was up to its eyeballs in this thing in 1965, which was a kind of universal program in the West to re-engineer man and to fit him into these little boxes where you could watch pornography and take drugs and be docile.
Absolutely. I've spoken about this for years, and the way that the folk home was kind of participatory in this too, a new concept of how to live and just how involved the government was in everything and all the decision making and stuff like that. And of course, as you said, I mean, it's by design. It was not like, oh, we made a mistake kind of thing. This was done to break the spirit. And I've looked at a lot of documentaries about some of the most beautiful parts of the older part of the cities, like Gothenburg, but this happened around in Stockholm and many other places as well, where they had taken, you know, the wooden constructed homes and people that they had lived in these homes for generations, the state came in and basically knocked them all down. And there were people so upset, so sad to having their roots destroyed in this way that they committed suicide. And then they moved them into these concrete shoe boxes, right? And it was it was sold to us as an upgrade. Well, listen, now it's a higher standard of living we're giving you now. This is great, you know?
That's exactly what they told the sharecroppers from Mississippi and Chicago. This is the first time when Gloria Hardy's mother moved into wherever it was. It wasn't the Robert Taylor homes. This is the first new building they'd ever lived in. They lived in shacks down south where they picked cotton, and now they're in their own little apartment. And it lasted for about a month, and then her father goes nuts because he can do whatever he wants as long as it's getting drunk. And we had the beginning of this pathology that was then used against the Catholic population of Chicago as part of their ethnic cleansing program. That's the story of Slaughter of Cities. That's the real story of what happened to places like Chicago, Detroit, every city, and Philadelphia, which is where I grew up.
Yeah, it's such a crime. And what I just quickly want to get, while we're on the issue of architecture then, and how... I mean, I was considered to be incredibly important. I mean, really, all the environments that mankind moves in needs to be so have an expression of something higher, right? Beyond this utilitarian, just base economic kind of level, which we're sold this kind of stuff at. But as you know, I've argued that it does help to kind of break the spirit of people if it's just it's a new, foreign, almost an alien environment that they're moving human beings into, and they lose that connection to the higher essence, right? That's how I view it anyway.
Well, it's materialism in stone. I think this was the high watermark of materialism. In other words, you're just a machine. You're the human machine. De La Mettrie wrote L'Homme Machine in the Enlightenment. The Marquis de Sade read that book, and he proposed a kind of materialistic worldview where it's just you have these functions, you have these drives, we'll just satisfy them. You need a certain amount of light, and this Gropius was thinking this way too. How much light do you need? How much space do you need? How much sex do you need? How much food do you need? How much blah blah blah, and we'll provide it all for you as long as you promise to accept this as heaven on earth. And a big part of this was sex. I'm not talking about
sex. Well, something needs to replace that hole, right, that people have in their souls after this. Right.
Because sex is a transcendent experience. And so if we can market it, we'll keep these people docile. So sex was a crucial element.
Yeah.
It's in, if you read Aldous Huxley's book, Brave New World, he talks about the feelies. That was pornography. He understood it because he was connected with the British elites who were working out this program during the 30s.
Don't forget about his brother, Julian Huxley, working for UNESCO. They're well tied into the globalist establishment. He got the inside scoop on this. He wrote what their plans were, basically.
And I'm saying it wasn't just Harry Schein. It wasn't just Schein and Bergman. It was Olof Palme as well.
Absolutely.
Olof Palme was a cultural minister during this period of time, okay, 64, when they did break the code in Germany. And so the government was heavily involved in this. The government kicked back money so that Bergman could keep making films. The money quickly, the filmmaking, there was an interesting film in this regard is the film Anita. Well, I don't know whether you've seen.
Yeah, I can't place it, but I do. I've heard it. Okay. Heard about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because Anita, what followed was pornography. But Anita is, in many ways, it's a combination of the serious art film a la Bergman, a serious sociological comment, interspersed with nudity. That's what we're talking about here, and it doesn't work. The parts don't work together, but that's what they were trying to do. Because what is Anita? She's the girl who comes from the provinces, and she comes from an oppressive father, and she comes into Stockholm, and she gets involved in sexual activity, and so they're trying to think this thing out in a way that will allow you to accept the new world, order that's being imposed on you. So she doesn't go back to the farm. She's not like, I'm sorry, I did that. My father was right. No, she heads off. She finally has sex with her social worker, and they head off to a hippie commune in the country. This is an attempt. It was a quasi-serious attempt to deal with what was happening in Sweden at the time. And then the moment just passed. And it just became hardcore pornography. Sweden became, and then once they're in hardcore pornography, well, then you don't need Ingmar Bergman anymore, because you've already broke down the laws, and so let's just have hardcore pornography. And that's led over to a kind of derangement of that generation, which would be probably my generation and a little bit younger. I was 20 years old in 68. So the baby boomers were one of the prime targets of this sexualization. And then they go on and they fail in their marriages, or their marriages break up, and the kids grow up without fathers. And guess what happens when children, male children, have father deprivation? They become homosexuals. And so you can see down the road how the homosexual movement is going to arise out of the wreckage of the baby boomer marriages.
Interesting. Let's note as well, Harry Schein, even just on the Wikipedia page, he says he's best known for his role in pushing through film reform 1963, which ensured that 10% of the money from cinema ticket sales was handed to a central film organization, Swedish Film or Svensk Film. This system guaranteed continuous production of Swedish films for several decades. It means that even if they failed economically, if people would have rejected these movies, there was enough money there to continue to make them, to ensure that this propaganda was pumped out. It's brilliant, right?
It was. And I'm telling you, Ingmar Bergman had a huge effect on the American consciousness during this time. All you have to do is look at a guy like Woody Allen. Woody Allen was even ended up hiring Max von Sydow. Is that how you say his name?
Von Sydow.
Von Sydow. That's
von Sydow. Yeah, Max von Sydow. He's a good actor, but yeah.
But anyway, he starred in Woody Allen films because Woody Allen, in his memoir, said, "What was it? Summer with Monica." Mm-hmm. Summer with Monica. What a big influence that early Bergman film had on him. And that it had a huge influence on my generation, because this was serious film. This was serious film. And we were supposed to take this as the new way we're going to do things. This, in other words, as an American, you look at somebody in Europe and you think they're serious. Hollywood isn't serious, but this guy from Sweden, he's serious. And this is art. And that's the reason it had such a big effect on America at that time.
What do you think of the Seventh Seal and the way, because that film is always, I mean, it's been praised and stuff, and there are some interesting kind of, you know, philosophical things in there, but it's obviously about doubt, a crusader that has doubt about the existence of God. He's being transformed, right? Have you seen the movie? Have you analyzed it from this perspective?
I saw that when I was 19 years old.
Yeah.
I remember it had a big, big influence on me. I mean, now in retrospect, it sounds like an autobiography of Ingmar Bergman, who was raised as a Lutheran and then suddenly loses his faith. So you're talking about the crisis of faith that's going through these countries at this at this particular period in time. By the way, I think that that is also running its course now. And that what you have in these formerly Protestant countries is the total collapse of Protestantism. And it's being filled by either white nationalism or Islam. Depending on whether you're male or female, it seems to me, the men go for white nationalism and the women go for Islam.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, it's happening. You know, it's our countries are transforming in rapid rate at this stage. Yeah,
I know, and that's part of. But I think that what you're seeing here is the earlier stage of the collapse of Protestantism in countries like Sweden, Protestant countries, officially Protestant countries. And so that's what that's what I got out of watching The Seventh Seal. It was a powerful movie, I have to admit.
It is. It's very good. I recommend people to look at it and stuff like that. But it's like, yeah, I felt it's, you know, he goes to a monastery, has conversations with priests and stuff. And as you said, it's very much his own story. There's actually a film out now. I think it's on Netflix. If you have it, cancel Netflix. But anyway, it's out on Netflix, and it's about his father and how Ingmar Bergman came to be. I forget if he was out of wedlock. I forget the whole story there, but there was some kind of controversy surrounding that and stuff like that. And of course, this kind of led to, his father was a very religious man, but they started showing that, you know, he had doubt and, you know, things like this. And Bergman kind of picked up on this later in his life, and he struggled supposedly with this question quite a bit, you know?
Yeah, the other side of the coin of Lutheranism is sexual license. Lutheranism had a devastating effect on the sexual morality in Germany, because Luther basically made a virtue, he made a theological virtue out of his lack of self-control. He struggled, he and his people were involved in basically breaking into convents and dragging the nuns out. It was women's liberation in the 16th century. And he was offering the nuns to, offered one to the Bishop of Mainz if he would join the Reformed Party. And eventually Luther is struggling against this himself. And he caves in, I can't do it anymore. So he ends up marrying the nun. And then within a year, he writes De Servo Arbitrio on the enslaved will. And what you had was basically God, Luther blaming God for every wrong thing he ever did. So his heir is Pete Buttigieg, the gay mayor from South Bend, who said God made him a homosexual. That's the heir of that. So the flip side of this coin, this doubt, is this sexual license that had a corrupting effect on German culture for centuries, including Hegel, which is what I'm writing about now in the Logos book. I'm up on the Hegel chapter. Mm-hmm. Hegel is trying to come, it's the French Revolution, it's Lutheran theology. He's caught in the middle. He's trying to figure out the Trinity. Napoleon abolishes the Holy Roman Empire. Napoleon rides into Jena. He's ready to send the phenomenology of the spirit off to the printer, and he hears from his chambermaid she's pregnant with his baby. All these things came together, and it forced Hegel into a kind of Lutheran understanding of the Trinity, which in effect corrupted the dialectic and turned it into the revolutionary spirit that Marx eventually called communism.
Very interesting. We're going to take a short break here in just a minute or so, and then I'm going to continue to talk more with you. Obviously, we've kind of mainly focused on, let me pull up the book here, of course. Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. But Dr. Jones, you have tons of titles on your website. Why don't we talk about some of those a little bit? I heard just in passing someone said that book was not available on Amazon, but it's not out of print.
Go to culturewars.com. Do not pay any more than $30 for that book. I don't care what the price is list. You can always get it for $30 on Amazon. And one other thing, please do not engage in piracy. Okay? The only edition is the paper edition, which you buy from culturewars.com.
Yeah, look at that. The hardcover is over $700 and the paperback is $130. So obviously,
this is outrageous. You can get it for $30 from culturewars.com.
Absolutely.
Now,
yeah.
If everybody who watches your program sends an order in, there may be a little bit of backlog, but we will make up. We will send the copies out. Okay.
Wonderful. And there's just shoot off a few other titles, if you will. What are you? Would you recommend people to dive into after they've read Libido Dominandi?
Well, I mean, the point I'm trying to make here is that if you put Libido Dominandi together with the Jewish revolutionary spirit, you'll suddenly be able to understand what happened in Sweden in 1964 in a way that these undoubtedly intelligent professors were not. They couldn't figure it out, because you have to have some type of framework. And what I'm trying to say here is, if you combine, what have you been talking about? We've been talking about Libido Dominandi, the slaughter of cities, and the Jewish revolutionary spirit. These are the tools I think you need to understand what happened to us, my generation, your generation, in these countries, because the professors are not going to tell you.
Absolutely not.
They'll lose their job if they tell you the truth about what happened. I lost my job, so why should I be any different than them?
Yeah, absolutely. Guys, check out all the titles. Is it all your written by you on the book page?
Pardon me?
Are all the books written by you?
They're all by me, yeah. Some of them are e-books.
A lot of titles.
You can go to Amazon Kindle and you can get e-books, and if you're in Sweden, they'll be, you know, you can get them right away.
Yeah.
You can download them. But the other books we're talking about, they're only in paper copy, and they're available from culturewars.com.
Absolutely, culturewars.com. Check that out. And of course, you do have a newsletter as well that goes out. What is it, monthly?
Culture Wars magazine, which comes out monthly.
Monthly, yeah.
Which virtually every book I've written began as articles in culturewars.com. And you have the letters column where we discuss things in a reasonable fashion every month. So that's you're ahead of the curve if you get culture wars.
Wonderful. Make sure you support the work of Dr. E. Michael Jones so that he can continue doing his good work. Ladies and gentlemen, we're just going to take a short break here. Then we'll be back in part two right after this. Stay with us, everybody. All right, ladies and gentlemen, please join us at redicemembers.com for the part two coming up here with E. Michael Jones from Culture Wars. We're going to dive into much more, actually, in terms of the Jewish revolutionary spirit. There's a lot of things we have lined up. We're also going to talk about Israel. We're going to talk about the building of the Third Temple, how they view the Moshiach and these kinds of things, the Messiah, the ascendancy of that. We'll spend some time on Trump and kind of the foreign policy just hurdle and issues that he's involved in right now. We're going to talk about why things like Syria and Venezuela more recently, the coups there keep on failing. A lot of interesting takes here from E. Michael Jones coming up. So definitely make sure that you head on over to redicemembers.com and sign up for a membership with us. Try it out for 3 months if you're new, or renew your membership. It's well worth it. Get access to our member section. All the material that we've ever done back to our start in 2006. We have over 1,700 entries on the member site. Hundreds and hundreds of hours of material for you there to dive into. And of course, you get also exclusive access to a lot of videos. And not the least, Weekend Warrior as well, the new show that we do together with Lana on redicemembers.com as well. Exclusive for all the members out there. So thank you so much again for checking out the first part here. But again, if you want to have more, check out redicemembers.com. That's the best way to support us as well. So we'll take a short break here. Then we'll be right back with E. Michael Jones in part two.
They are rejoicing.